This is On Target St. John's, a look at politics, crime, education. What's happening here with the people who know? The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station. Now, your On Target St. John's host, Linda Swain.
And good afternoon, everyone. Back after a week's vacation, very restful, I must say. Not the best weather, of course. I think we saw a little sliver of sunshine this morning, of course, just as I'm heading back into work. But be that as it may, I got to spend some time with my sissy. She was down for the first time in, since the before times, a long time now, so it was great. Really enjoyed every moment of it. Well, you may recall back in March, or you may not. It feels like a long time now. But back in March, it was World Sleep Day, and we had Dr. Sheila Garland with Memorial University Sleep Health and Wellness Lab on the show. And if memory serves, it was a sort of an abbreviated show because, of course, everything was going mad with COVID back then. And so we had to abbreviate the show to accommodate a live briefing from the province. But what a response we got to that particular show. It seems that an awful lot of people want to hear more about healthy sleep, restful sleep, making sure they're able to get to sleep and stay asleep when they do fall asleep. Well, my guest today, Dr. Sheila Garland, I've wanted her back on the show ever since then because we had such a great response, and she's joining me now. Hello.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on and being so agreeable to do this. So I guess start with the basics. What is the Sleep Health and Wellness Lab at Memorial University, and what do you do?
So we are a research lab, and we conduct research on both clinical and community samples. So that means that we look at people with particular conditions. So a lot of my research focuses on individuals who have had a cancer diagnosis, because those people with cancer suffer from sleep disturbances at 2 to 3 times the rate of the general population. But when looking at the general population, we also look at factors that influence sleep overall in large samples, like across Canada. And then we also look at students, right? That's the sample that I have at the university, people that I have access to. So our research really cuts across a lot of populations, looking at how do we identify people who have problems sleeping, how do we prevent sleep problems from occurring to begin with, and then once they've been established, what are the most effective treatments to help with sleep problems?
So you seem to imply there, when you're talking about cancer patients, I mean, that's got to be one of the most stressful times in your life to get that kind of a diagnosis and then go through the treatments. And my understanding is that more research and information is emerging into the health impacts of sleep, why sleep is so important to your health, but also your own health and that impact on sleep. So it seems like it's a bit of a circle.
Right. Yeah, you do have that bidirectional relationship. I consider sleep to be sort of one of those foundational health behaviors, which if it's not solid, is going to influence everything else in your life. So it's going to influence your work productivity. It's going to impact your mood. It's going to impact your cognitive function. It's going to impact your relationships. It's going to impact your physical functioning. And like you said, there we're learning more and more all the time about the importance of sleep for maintaining a healthy body and a healthy mind. So I also think that sleep is one of the things that people ignore the most, and it needs to get the spotlight as much or more than the things that people, you know, would maybe try first, you know, like, oh, okay, well, I should eat better food, or I should get more physical activity. But if you're not sleeping well, you're not going to be the person who's getting up to go to the 6 a.m. spin class, or you're not going to be the one to say, I think I have enough willpower to resist that second piece of cake, right? Because when you're tired, you're going to sleep in. You're not going to, go for that walk because you're tired. And you're going to be like, oh, I'm so tired. I think that piece of cake is going to make me feel better. So I think that sleep is one of those things that if you intervene on that particular aspect of somebody's life, you can make improvements in so many other areas. And so as a clinician, because I also treat patients in my own practice, I see that, you know, once you get people sleeping better, they come into my office and they're a different person.
It really is true. I mean, I think we all know what it's like to be a little bit cranky because you haven't had that sleep that you need.
Right. And, you know, that's just like the average person. Like, everybody is going to have a night of bad sleep. But when this isn't just a night, when it's night after night, at least, you know, three or more times per week, at least for 3 months, like, that's when it's on the level of an actual diagnosable disorder that's called insomnia, right? And that's the inability to get to sleep or stay asleep despite adequate opportunity for sleep. And there's other sleep disorders as well, but insomnia is really, really common.
So why is sleep so important to the body?
Well, if you can think about it, it's the time when it gives your body a chance to focus on repair and restoration. So, you know, if we look at the specific sleep stages, so what our brain is doing during sleep, it's actually so fascinating. So it's taking the events and things that we've experienced, things that we've learned, and it's transferring that experience and information into its appropriate memory, if it's going to go into short-term memory, if it's going to go into long-term memory. It's processing difficult emotions during REM sleep. So that's the stage of sleep where, you know, we have, you know, vivid emotional dreams, and that's associated with activation in the brain area called the amygdala, which is associated with strong emotions. So, you know, if you've had a particularly stressful day, you might find that you have sort of more vivid emotional dreams. And so it's your brain's way of processing those emotions, which is why you can go to sleep feeling one way and wake up feeling like, oh, you know what, I actually feel better, you know, almost more emotionally balanced. When we're in our slow wave sleep, so our stage three sleep, you know, that's when our body is doing the physical repair. So in kids, that's when the growth hormone is pumped out into the system, which is why, you know, you can put your kid to bed in size this size clothes and they wake up in another size clothes.
It's true. It's so true.
You know, it's responsible for regulating your appetite hormones. It's responsible for, you know, cardiovascular health and blood pressure regulation. So there's so many fascinating things that sleep is essential for. So when we mess up sleep, whether that be through a sleep disorder like insomnia, if it's sleep apnea, if it's something like shift work, we can see breakdown in all of those functions that the brain is doing during sleep. And so this is where we see problems in emotion, problems in cognition, problems in, you know, physical health problems as well.
My guest today on Target is Dr. Sheila Garland with Memorial University Sleep Health and Wellness Lab. We're talking about sleep, of course. So stay tuned, stay up, and listen to what we have to say coming up right after this.
Saturday morning, join us for the Irish Newfoundland Show. Send your request to irishnl@vocm.com or submit them online at vocm.com.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
My guest today is Dr. Sheila Garland with Memorial University Sleep Health and Wellness Lab, and we've been talking about the importance of sleep, but how much sleep does a person normally need?
So this is something that I think causes people some stress because they think that there's somehow a magic number. And for people, I think, you know, some people have been taught that that number is 8. And it's actually not the case. There's a range and it changes depending on how old you are, right? So, you know, usually it flattens out, like kids, you know, adolescents up into young adults, they need the most sleep. And then once we reach adulthood, it usually ranges anywhere from about 6 to 9 hours. There's sort of this bimodal distribution where those who are getting under 6 hours of sleep are at higher risk of negative health outcomes, and those who are over 9 hours are at greater risk of worse outcomes. So it's not, sleep isn't something that more is all always better. There seems to be a genetic component on like whatever your sleep need is. So when I'm working with people, I'll often say like, you know, okay, tell me, you know, what your sleep pattern was like when you physically felt the best. Maybe that means, you know, you were camping or, you know, on holidays or something like that, and you had a regular sleep-wake routine. And so, you know, it's different for each person, but the amount of sleep that you need is basically what you get when you are able to feel good and function the next morning. Now, that being said, there's other things that contribute to not feeling well during the day. So sometimes people will attribute that, oh, I must not be getting enough sleep because I'm fatigued. And so then they try and get more sleep. And the fatigue isn't actually a consequence of their sleep. It's a consequence of something else. But then the person starts worrying, like, I'm fatigued and I'm trying to get more sleep, but I can't get more sleep. And so then sleep becomes a problem that they're trying to fix, but it wasn't a problem in the first place.
You mentioned for most adults, there's this range, 6 to 9 hours. I think I'm closer to the 9 than I am to the 6, if you know what I mean, when I feel rested. But what constitutes a good night's sleep? Because a lot of people wake up in the middle of the night, toss and turn a little bit, get back to sleep, or some don't. What constitutes a good night's sleep?
And you know, that's a really good question, because it's going to change, too, depending on what phase of life you're in. So I think a lot of people have an unrealistic expectation that they should fall asleep quickly, they should stay asleep the entire night, and they should wake up in the morning and basically feel able to just launch themselves out of bed and start their day. And that's a complete unrealistic expectation of your sleep. So if it takes you less than 30 minutes to fall asleep, that's good. If you wake up in the middle of the night but you're awake for less than 30 minutes, that's good too. And that means that, you know, you might wake up, you know, 2 times, 3 times, but if you're able to fall back asleep relatively quickly, that's not a problem. We actually cycle through our stages of sleep about every 90 minutes for about, you know, depending on how long you're sleeping, you know, maybe 5 or 7 times. So it's normal to kind of become aroused or wake up during a lighter sleep stage, and that's when we might shift our body position, you know, because our shoulder's getting sore, or we might go to the bathroom because we notice that our bladder's getting full in the middle of the night. So those brief periods of awakenings are good. We always wake up, but we may not actually remember that we've woken up because there's an amnestic effect. You know, we forget. If we fall back asleep relatively quickly afterwards, we even forget that we've been awake. So that's an important thing for people to know, is just because you wake up doesn't mean that your sleep is bad. But if you wake up and you're unable to fall back asleep, then there's a concern there. Or if you wake up in the morning after having, you know, the night of sleep, and you just feel like you haven't slept at all, that can be a problem too, because in this province especially, there's a high rate of undiagnosed obstructive sleep apnea. And so that means that you actually stop breathing during sleep. And when you stop breathing during sleep, it actually forces you out of that deeper, more restorative sleep. And so you're not getting those restorative properties. So if you wake up in the morning just as bagged as you feel when you went to sleep, I'd be consulting with your doctor to see if you could get a screening for obstructive sleep apnea.
And I was going to ask you about that. So what kind of an impact? I mean, there's sleep apnea and there's snoring. The two of them are not necessarily the same thing, but they can be linked sometimes. If you're snoring a lot, what kind of an impact can that have on you or the other people in your household?
Yeah. So if it's snoring that isn't related to sleep apnea, it's more disruptive to your bed partner than yourself. A lot of people would snore, right? If you've got congested sinuses, sometimes it has to do with, you know, too many blows to the nose, playing ice hockey, or, you know, something else like that. So if it's anatomical in nature, you know, sometimes little things like body position during sleep can help with snoring, but it doesn't affect the individual's ability to get their full range of sleep stages. When it's obstructive sleep apnea, it prevents people from getting into slow wave sleep and REM sleep, because as you go into those deeper sleep stages, your muscles in your body relax, and the tissues around your airway also relax. So you're more likely to have an apnea in those sleep stages. So your body basically preserves your life by bringing you out of those sleep stages. And so this is why people with obstructive sleep apnea are the ones that are falling asleep, you know, given 5 minutes to sit down. They're the ones falling asleep in the clinic chairs in waiting rooms or in restaurants or, you know, even at a red light. So it can be quite dangerous. Untreated sleep apnea, the consequences there, because you've just got this excessive daytime sleepiness.
Do you see many sleeping disorders?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I would say probably the three, four most common ones that I see clinically, insomnia would be the first one. I also see that oftentimes with restless leg syndrome. And then I also see people with circadian rhythm sleep disorders. So this means that, you know, their body cycle, their sleep-wake cycle doesn't follow the traditional sort of like, you know, 11 to 7 sort of sleep. So they're either like night owls, extreme night owls, or extreme early birds. So I don't see as many of the people with obstructive sleep apnea, because that's usually handled through the clinics that specialize in that. But oftentimes people will have concerns around adherence to the treatments recommended for sleep apnea. So sometimes I will, you know, work with people who are having difficulty adhering to their treatment and help them be able to use the treatment to make sure that they get the best results.
I want to talk to you a little bit more about insomnia in the next segment, because I think that's kind of a bigger topic in and of itself. But describe to us restless leg syndrome or disorder, because I know I've heard some people say that, you know, I've never had it, and then all of a sudden I had it. What is it exactly?
Restless legs is an infuriating condition. It really is infuriating because it feels like somebody is like it's a twitchy, tingling. Sometimes it can feel like, you know, kind of creepy crawly in your feet, legs, and calves. And it always happens sort of at, you know, prior to sleep onset. So, you know, you can be completely tired and then all of a sudden your like feet feel twitchy and jerky. And so if you can imagine you're falling asleep and, you know, somebody just keeps on waking you up each time you try and fall asleep, you know, that's what I mean. It's like frustratingly, it's maddening when your legs are, you know, keeping you awake there. So, and it can be related to a number of things. It can be related to low iron. So women who are pregnant or, you know, have low iron, it can be related to certain medications. So it's important if you are having this sort of symptom that you get that checked out with your family physician. So, you know, could anything else be contributing to this? And see if you can eliminate that in order to fix it, because it is really, really such a frustrating condition.
Yeah, because I imagine you would move your legs around just to try and get rid of that feeling, and then that's keeping you awake, and it's a terrible cycle, I would imagine.
That's right. And people are walking around their house and they're trying, you know, warm baths, and they're trying to massage, they're trying to exercise, thinking like, if I just, you know, wear my legs out, maybe that'll give me some relief, but it doesn't. You know, it is treated sometimes by, medications that work on, you know, dopamine in the brain or certain neurological medications. So, you know, there is a brain cause to it as well.
My guest today on Target is Dr. Sheila Garland. She's with Memorial University Sleep Health and Wellness Lab. We're talking about sleep and a good night's sleep. We're going to get into a little bit more about what causes problems for you when you can't get to sleep, coming up right after this.
Weekday mornings from 5:30 to 9. Jumpstart your day with Jerry Lynn Mackey and Ben Murphy. Newsmakers, traffic, weather, and more during your VOCM morning show.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
My guest today is Dr. Sheila Garland with Memorial University's Sleep Health and Wellness Lab. And we were talking about sleep disorders a little bit earlier, Dr. Garland, and you mentioned insomnia, of course. But what is insomnia, and when do you know you have a problem? I mean, everybody goes through a sleepless night from time to time, but when does it become a problem?
Right. So you're absolutely right. You know, insomnia happens to everybody. It's usually associated with some sort of stressful life event. So, you know, something that's keeping you up at night. And then it's typical for once that stress is resolved, people typically go back to sleeping as they did before. So when it becomes a problem is when it happens more often than not, and it has been happening for at least 3 months. So this is the kind of cutoff that we use. So if it's happening, you know, more than three nights per week and more than 3 months, you may meet a diagnostic criteria for insomnia disorder. In the past, people used to consider it just like a, you know, maybe a symptom of some other disorder. So people would go to their physicians and they would say, you know, oh, well, I'm not sleeping. And somebody would say, oh, well, you must be depressed, right? But we know more now that insomnia is not just a symptom. It's a syndrome in and of itself, because what we know is that even if you treat something else, like even if you treat the depression or even if you treat the pain or, you know, something that's related to the insomnia, if you don't treat the insomnia as an independent condition, that sticks around. It doesn't necessarily go away when the other condition has resolved.
So how is it treated then?
So we know a lot about how to effectively treat insomnia, and there's guidelines that have been out now since, you know, from the American College of Physicians since 2015, and there's similar ones for specific populations, so even in cancer populations, that the treatment with the most evidence of efficacy for long-term improvement is something that you might not expect. It's actually cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia. And this has been compared to drugs, to medications for insomnia. And what we know when we compare this on a head-to-head study, looking at it compared to medication, we know that medication might take effect more quickly, right? You take medication, maybe it's going to work that night for you. But then as soon as you stop taking the medication, the insomnia tends to return. So with cognitive behavior therapy, normally people will go through, you know, a series of weekly treatments for anywhere from usually, you know, maybe 6 to 10 weeks. And but during that treatment, they actually learn how to manage the insomnia themselves, how to treat the insomnia themselves. So compared to the medication that, you know, treats it quickly, but then it just comes back, it may take longer to see effects with the cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia, but then they're more durable because people know if they do experience sleep problems in the past, they know how to manage them.
Is there a particular type of person who's more likely to suffer insomnia than someone else? And is there a stage in life when you're more likely to suffer insomnia?
Insomnia can actually be diagnosed across the age range, you know, starting in childhood. But we do tend to see it more in adults and older adults. Women are twice as likely to experience insomnia than men, although that ratio tends to equal out as men get older. There's a period in midlife for women when, you know, a lot of things converge, which can make sleep hard, right? So, you know, for women in midlife, you might have menopause impacting your sleep. You may have, you know, stress. You know, we call that sort of like the sandwich generation. They're, you know, caring for their own kids and maybe they're caring for their aging parents. So there's lots of stress kind of happening in that midlife. So that can make it more likely for women at that time to experience insomnia. But we also see it in like young adulthood too, where, you know, people have newfound independence, you know, maybe they're starting their own families, and that's when insomnia can kick in, when there's more stresses. So, yeah, it can happen throughout.
What about just plain bad habits, like not getting to bed at a certain hour and not waking up at a certain hour? You know what I mean? Just some of those bad little habits we get into, saying, oh, yeah, no, I'll stay up till 2 and study, and then I'll be up for the, and I'll catch up on my sleep later.
Yeah, I think, you know, maybe a lot of people go through a phase where they can get away with that, but that doesn't last forever. So it can catch up to people. So maybe in young adulthood, you can withstand, you know, more the effects of disruptions to your sleep. It doesn't impact you, or you're not aware of the impact that it has on you. And I think that there's certain people who, you know, just like the people who can get away with having a bad diet and not have the same immediate health consequences as somebody else. There's certain people that, you know, say, I can do anything. I can drink a pot of coffee and go to sleep and, you know, that kind of thing. So there are people who are more sensitive, but there are certain things that can help, or at least, you know, lessen the likelihood that people will experience sleep problems. And you talked about, you know, having kind of a routine. The most important thing that people can do is have a consistent wake-up time. It's not actually about the time you go to bed, it's about the time you wake up. Because our sleep is controlled on a homeostatic mechanism. So, you know, the less is followed by more is followed by less. It's always trying to balance it out. Same as like a thermostat, right? It's kind of trying to, you know, find this balance. And so, for example, if we've got 24 hours in a day and I'm an 8-hour sleeper, then if I take 8 away from 24 hours, I've got 16 hours left in the day. So from the time I wake up, let's say I wake up at 7 o'clock in the morning, I have 16 hours of sleep pressure to build before I'm likely to fall asleep again, which means that I'm likely to fall asleep at around 11. So it's actually more important what time you wake up, because if I decide, all right, I'm going to sleep in until 9, then I'm not likely to fall asleep until 1. If I sleep in until 11, I'm not likely to fall asleep until 3. So it's really the morning wake-up time that's important. This is why people experience what's called like Sunday night insomnia after sleeping in on Saturday, because they're out, you know, doing their thing on Friday night and Saturday night. So they sleep in Saturday morning and Sunday morning, and then they find themselves unable to sleep Sunday night. It's really because of that sleeping in behavior.
What about the impact of things like alcohol or caffeine?
Yeah, so you know, caffeine is a wonderful drug for, you know, to use strategically, but we have to recognize it as a drug, right? So, you know, it is a stimulant, and, you know, it's a legal stimulant, but it absolutely is. So, you know, there's nothing, you know, for, according to an individual's choice, there's nothing wrong with having, you know, a cup of coffee in the morning. But, you know, the half-life of that drug is about 6 hours. So you want to make sure that you're not having it too close to the time that you go to bed so it doesn't impact your ability to fall asleep. It actually, interestingly, it binds to a neuromodulator in our brain called adenosine, which the buildup of adenosine is the mechanism for that sleep drive that I was just referring to. So adenosine starts building up from the time we wake up. So caffeine binds to that adenosine. And so then it makes this, you know, not feel as sleepy, not recognize that sleep drive. But it only lasts for so long until the bind wears off, and then you might get this surge of sleepiness afterwards.
And alcohol, does that have an impact on sleep?
So it can help with you falling asleep, but normally it disrupts your sleep stage architecture. So that's what I mean when I say, like, you know, you're cycling from, you know, sleep stages. So it can impact your sleep quality and impact the time that you spend in various sleep stages. So even though people might use it to help them get to sleep, the impact on their sleep quality is usually negative.
Is it wise to, fall back on a sleep aid if you're having trouble falling asleep?
Sleep aids have a purpose and a place. They're really intended for short-term use. So, you know, for example, in a case where somebody's diagnosed with cancer, you might say, you know what, this is just a really, really stressful time in my life right now. I can't get to sleep no matter what I do. For a short term, sleep aids can be very, very helpful, but they're not intended for long-term use. So if you're finding that, you know, you're relying on them for more than, you know, 1 to 2 weeks, finding other strategies is going to be very, very important. I think physicians are getting more and more reluctant to prescribe long-term prescriptions of sleep aids. Long-term sleep aid use has been associated with a whole host of negative consequences. An increase in falls is one of them, especially among the elderly, cognitive impairments. And as much as people say that they're not, they don't increase dependence, they do. People get psychologically reliant on them.
Are there other more natural sleep aids that you could use? You know, some people will say chamomile tea or something like that. Is there anything, you know, that's a more natural type of sleep aid to help you relax?
So I would say that, you know, for somebody with, you know, insomnia disorder, and that's what I previously described as somebody who's had, you know, problems for, you know, more than three times per week for more than 3 months, there's not a great deal of evidence for anything other than either the cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia that I mentioned or for pharmacotherapy. But for people who, you know, maybe just, you know, want to relax before bed, chamomile tea, you know, is not going to hurt them. Often people will turn to things like melatonin. They've done studies that have looked at melatonin for the treatment of insomnia disorder, and it really doesn't do much more than a placebo pill would. But that being said, a placebo is an active treatment effect, right? So if you think about the behavioral changes that occur when somebody believes that something is going to impact their sleep, they, you know, take the medication and then they stop worrying or they stop trying to sleep, which is what somebody with insomnia does, is they go to bed and they try harder to sleep. Or, you know, they worry, am I going to sleep tonight? But if you have a belief in the medication or the melatonin that is going to work, people will often find, oh yeah, it helped me for a couple of days and it stopped working. Right? And it didn't actually really help them. It was just more of their expectation.
My guest today on Target is Dr. Sheila Garland. She's with Memorial University Sleep Health and Wellness Lab. And when we come back, I'm going to ask you a couple other questions about sleep, but I also want to ask you about some of the research you're doing coming up right after this.
The workday winds down with Greg Smith in the Drive. Get up to speed on the day's events and current traffic, weather, and community updates each weekday afternoon on your VOCM.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
My guest today on Target is Dr. Sheila Garland of Memorial University Sleep Health and Wellness Lab. And we're talking about going to sleep. And you said that, you know, part of the problem sometimes when you have that lack of sleep or you're suffering a bit of insomnia is you get in the bed. I know I've done it. Okay, I'm going to sleep now. All right. And you pull the covers over and you're tightened all up and your muscles are all in, you're squinching your eyes shut and then you're not comfortable and you toss and you turn again. You're looking at the clock. It's like, okay, it's 2 o'clock. Oh God, now it's 3 o'clock and now it's 4 o'clock and I'm still not asleep. And you're getting more frustrated. I mean, how do you get out of those kinds of terrible patterns?
Yeah, so I would say the first thing to do is not get into bed until you are feeling sleepy. And then if you're not asleep within, you know, 20, 30 minutes, get out of bed. The longer you stay in bed, it actually increases the likelihood you're not going to fall asleep. Because as you just explained, you know, you're sitting there and you're feeling like, oh, am I sleeping now? And you actually start getting more frustrated, more ticked off, more angry, more concerned, more worried, right? So your emotional intensity is increasing and that's not conducive to sleep at all. You know, the other thing would be don't look at the clock, right? Turn your clock away because then as soon as you look at it, you automatically engage your frontal lobe, which shouldn't be engaged when you're trying to fall asleep because you're doing math, right? Like if I fall asleep now, okay, I'll get this many hours of sleep and then I'll be able to, you know, function the next day. So it would be to get out of bed, go somewhere else, and start doing something that doesn't have the purpose of falling asleep. And it's the best to distract yourself by doing something pleasant, non-stimulating, in dim light, sedentary. So, you know, reading a book, listening to a podcast or, you know, an audio book or music, you know, something that can just distract your brain. And then actually you're able to feel yourself getting sleepy again. And then as soon as you feel yourself getting sleepy again, go back to the bed and then try, you know, then, you know, see what happens. See if you fall asleep then.
What about you fall asleep, you have no trouble falling asleep, you're asleep for a little while, you turn over and then the brain starts going, oh, I got to write that report. Oh, I have no idea how I'm going to get that done between then and then, and I got to take so-and-so to the doctor and I got to pick this up. And you're going through all of those little things in your brain. How do you stop that from happening in the middle of the night when you've already started to sleep and now you're awake?
You preempt it. So, you know, your brain is going to take that time from you. You just don't want it to take it from your sleep. So it would be, all right, so before you get into bed, give yourself, you know, 15, 20 minutes and be like, all right, what is my to-do list? So you have to give your brain that opportunity to do that sort of like planning. It could be writing your to-do list like that, or it could be like, okay, what am I going to paint the walls, or, you know, what's going to be my menu list, or whatever it might be. But giving yourself that opportunity to do it outside of the bed, and then if you do find yourself thinking about it, then just, you know, reminding yourself, I've already processed that, or, you know, do it first thing in the morning. Doing that planning at that time. So I'll do this first thing in the morning, I'll plan this. Just giving yourself that opportunity.
What about the place you sleep in, your bed, your bed clothes, the temperature in the room, the lighting in the room? Do those make a difference?
They can, you know, they can all add up, right? Each one, you know, may not be all that substantial in and of itself, but combined, they can. So you want to be comfortable. You definitely want it to be dark. That is, you know, really, really important. Cool bedroom is better than a warm bedroom. And also, if somebody's sensitive to sound, having a white noise machine on in the background, you know, that can help produce that sort of like soothing environment.
I used to know a little fella who used to always have these kind of jungle sounds going on in the background. He had to have it.
Yeah, and we can become conditioned to associate certain things with sleep. And so that's why you want to make sure that what you're conditioning to be associated with sleep is helpful. So this is why you don't want to be conditioning your bed to be associated with thinking, planning, worrying, ruminating, you know, being angry. So this is why I say get out of bed. You know, don't provide that association between your bed and that mental activity. This is why people with insomnia can often find themselves sleepy and able to fall asleep on the couch, but as soon as they go to bed, they find their mind is racing. That means that they've conditioned their bed to be the trigger to elicit that sort of mental activity. And that only happens after night after night after night, sort of pairing the bed with things other than sleep.
So what kind of stuff are you doing there now at the at your research lab?
Yeah, so one of the biggest issues with insomnia and getting treatment is that there's just not enough treatment providers in the province. So so I'm focusing on cancer survivors now. We've got a, you know, high percentage of people in the province who have had a cancer diagnosis at some point in their history. And, you know, because of the need and the level of impact that sleep has, focusing on cancer survivors in Newfoundland and Labrador and across the Atlantic provinces. And we are providing telehealth or video delivered cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia. So we have a treatment program that is evidence-based, and it is available via video to anybody who has had a cancer diagnosis at any time in the past, and they have to be at least 6 months completed their treatment or considered, you know, sort of stable. So this means that people who have active disease can also be participating as long as they're stable, according to their oncologist. And they have to have experienced insomnia, but also report issues with their memory, concentration, and attention. So what we're investigating is whether if we can treat insomnia, does that actually improve one of the other most common consequences of cancer treatment, which is, you know, brain fog or cognitive impairment? And this has really important implications for, like, going back to work and work performance, presenteeism, absenteeism. So trying to get, you know, the province, people in the province and the Atlantic provinces more generally, sort of back to feeling good after cancer and getting a good night's sleep.
And how can people contact you for, you know, some guidance, or is that not what you do, if you know what I mean?
They absolutely can. We try and provide resources to anybody who reaches out to us. So if they're not eligible for our studies, we try and refer them to other options that they might be able to avail of. So the email that they can contact us at is sleeplab@mun.ca.
sleeplab@mun.ca. What's ahead
for us? Oh my gosh, the next, I'm actually doubling down on my ability or on my initiatives to try and increase people's access to cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia by creating an app specifically for cancer survivors. So really trying to make sure that everybody, regardless of geographic location, is able to access an evidence-based treatment and they can get a good night's sleep.
An app? That sounds so interesting.
Yeah. So we're in the planning stages right now.
And how might that work? You know, without giving away too much, I suppose. You know, would it just provide that information that somebody needs, or they're having trouble sleeping? They look at the app and say, okay, I forgot. I need to do these kinds of exercises before, you know, those kinds of things, or what?
So it's tricky because it would be taking all of the clinical treatment algorithms I have in my head when I work with people and sort of automating an app to be able to, look at the information that the individual is reporting, you know, in the app about their sleep, and then follow the same treatment algorithms that I would use in my head in this app.
That's fascinating. So might it be individualized too, or?
Oh, it's totally individualized. Yep. So it would be, people would be, they would get the same sort of individualized sleep program that I would provide. And then I plan to have additional modules. So if somebody comes in with insomnia, but they also have hot flashes, then they would say, I also want some recommendations for hot flashes, or if they have pain, or if they have fatigue or mood disturbances. So it's really trying to be a comprehensive intervention for insomnia and cancer survivors and break down those geographical barriers.
Dr. Sheila Garland, this has been a pleasure for certain. I really appreciate your time this afternoon. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Sheila Garland is with Memorial University Sleep Health and Wellness Lab, and you can reach them at sleeplab@mun.ca. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned for that.